welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we're speaking with Professor Philip Bobbitt about his 2008 book, Terror and Consent. Here in this book, he talks about the transformation that the whole world is making from what he sees as a nation state, the provider of goods, to a market state, where the state more creates opportunities. And he sees that this transformation is causing certain types of terrorism. And some ideas of the terrorists is to create these big states of terror instead of states of consent of the people. We're going to be asking about it right now. Thanks so much to Professor Bobbitt for coming on the show. And let's ask him about the vulnerabilities of the new market state.
Sure. The essential thing to know about the vulnerabilities that market states bring with them is that they are not easily detached from the benefits that market states bring. Market states are the creatures of a globalized economy, an international system of human rights, the commodification of weapons of mass destruction, the increasing vulnerability of financial institutions to very distant events, and all of those threats are the kind of flip side of the enormous increase in wealth that market states produce. Not just for the richest people, although that's certainly true, but also for the poorest. In the last 20 years, more than 40% of the people on the earth earning less than $1 a day have come above $2 a day. Now, that doesn't sound like very much, but a doubling of incomes along that broad a base is really unprecedented. And it's the development of these global, international, legal, trading, and strategic systems that makes that possible.
Professor, I think one of the main, you know, I think the thesis also revolves around the idea that the conditions that create the market state also create terrorism. So essentially, the devolution, decentralization, globalization, network nature of the market state is very similar to terrorism as we see it today, in the form of Al Qaeda. And I think, even though your book specifically deals with Al-Qaeda, you have said that these conditions are going to continue as the market state emerges essentially as we see more and more market states, because right now we're seeing emerging market states rather than them being in their full form. And you said that essentially it's not confined to Muslim terrorism or Islamic fundamentalism, but that we can have, for instance, animal rights terrorists or eco-terrorists or anti-globalization terrorists. But I think the question is, if we assume that these conditions will exist always, does that necessarily lead to the conclusion of inevitable terrorism?
I think so. But that doesn't mean victory for terrorism or that we can't defeat terrorism. The reason I say that market state terrorists copy the functions of market states and the way they go about their business is because that has been the historical pattern with terrorists in the past. People who say, sometimes with a great deal of confidence, that they know how to handle terrorism, they're familiar with terrorism, it's a law enforcement problem, they are citing cases from the 20th century. They have in mind the IRA, the FLN, the PKK, ETA, with whom we were never at war. But they neglect to look at terrorism in earlier centuries. When you do that, when you look at the terrorism of princely states in the 16th century, kingly states in the 17th century, the great territorial states of the 18th century, the imperial states of the 19th century, you see that terrorism mimics the constitutional order that it attacks. So if you have a the 20th century industrial nation state, very hierarchical, very corporatist. You get that kind of terror. And you do get the FLN and the PLO and the IRA and so on. But when the state changes, when it becomes more decentralized, more global, more networked, and starts outsourcing its operations, then you get a terror that adopts those forms. The remarkable thing about Al-Qaeda is just that it happened to be the first. It was building upon a global base of Islamic fundamentalism, and that made it easier to have a global network. But I tell my students, if every jihadist became a Presbyterian, you'd still have this problem. And you mentioned some of the groups that might take it up, probably groups we haven't even thought of yet. Cults, criminal conspiracies, things that I haven't had the imagination to concoct.
Related to this idea of the market states and the emerging market states and how, you know, essentially the conditions that are created also create terrorism, the focus of your book has essentially been on the emerging market states such as the US and the UK, Indonesia, India, Australia, Japan, for instance.
Yes.
And then I think even though this is not extremely devoted in your book, you do label states like Liberia and I would say potentially Pakistan as well as struggling market states. And now we see that states like that, such as Pakistan, is also facing a terrorism of its own with the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda that has essentially now penetrated inside that country and is unleashing profound attacks. In what sense, first, are those states failed? In what sense are those states struggling market states? Because it seems that they haven't even really developed into nation states that can take care of their own people and provide universal education or universal healthcare. So first, in what states do you categorize them as struggling market states? And how is their struggle against terrorism different from the emerging market states or those that are more developed as market states, such as the UK or the US?
Yeah, I don't think of Liberia, Pakistan as struggling market states. I think of them as struggling nation states. And they produce a terrorism that is intensely nationalistic. What's confusing about this is that Al-Qaeda allies itself with old-fashioned nation-state terrorists wherever it can and uses those groups to outsource its operations. So it's very confusing for us to look at some of the terrorist groups that have been operating in Kashmir for many decades and see that they are participating in atrocities funded by, directed by Al-Qaeda. You want to say, now, wait a minute, is this a market state terror group? Is it a nation state terror group? And so on. I would say that in many parts of the globe, in Somalia, in Indonesia, that you have old-fashioned nation-state terror groups who have been allied for operational purposes with Al-Qaeda. So I don't think of Pakistan and Liberia as emerging or even struggling market states for the very reasons that you gave. And I think that my focus on the leading market states is based on the fact that they've seen in the past that the great powers among states seems to be the ones whose constitutional innovations are picked up by everybody else. You probably have something like a market state in Singapore already, but Americans and Europeans don't study that model. They're looking at the Chinese model. And if you look at the evolution of the constitutional order in Europe, it's typically a small handful of the most powerful states whose innovations set the terms for the next century?
Focusing on the states of terror and the dichotomy between the states of terror and the states of consent, I think one of the most, I think, cogent arguments that you have for why organizations like Al-Qaeda, for instance, really, you know, it's not just that they use terror as a means, but that terror in and of itself is an end, in the sense that they do not really believe that it should be based, that if they really were to have a state, it should be based on the consent of the governed, but it should be based on some higher God-made law, which they obviously will interpret according to however they want. And essentially, their version would obviously not really involve universal suffrage. It may not involve the protection of minorities and many other things that we have seen either Al-Qaeda itself voice while it struggles against the West or other developing countries, as well as we've seen some form of this in the Taliban. But I think in your book also there is a sense in which you also label other groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas as states of terror. And is it fair to lump them in that same category without recognizing the nuances, especially since these groups have somehow participated in parliamentary systems and essentially they have, you know, for instance, as Hamas is struggling with Al-Qaeda in Palestine, it is now it has agreed with the PLO to somehow show you know, one face to the Israelis, and I think recently it even said that it will accept an Israel on 1967 borders. So generally the question is it okay to lump all these groups as one without recognizing the nuances?
No, probably not. The difficulty with Hamas and with Hezbollah is that their agenda seems so mixed, and it seems to be in flux. You're quite right in saying that both of them have participated in democratic elections at times quite successfully. And you're also right in saying that they sometimes have manifestos that preach democracy, which is one element, though by no means the only element in the state of consent. At the same time, they have made horrific statements about, for example, Jews that are hard to square with the state of consent, not because of the consent part. Hitler was brought to power by a democratic election, but because of the human rights dimension. A country that starts sending out people across the globe, for example, to Latin America, to kill Jews just because they're Jews, has a hard time maintaining that it's seeking a state of consent, not because of the consent aspect, but because of the terror aspect. If terrorism should be defined as the use of violence for a political agenda to prevent people from what they have a lawful right to do, if that's the definition, then a state of terror is more than just a state that doesn't have elections. Indeed, it may very well have elections. But it's a state that tries to use terror to prevent people from acting lawfully. Whether you're blowing up a bus on the school children or you're attacking a marketplace, people just going about their ordinary lives who you are prepared to murder and maim. Now, it may be that the Hamas-Fatah alliance will turn them in a different direction. I can't tell. In the first place, I'm not a Middle Eastern regional expert. In the second place, I read such contradictory things. There was a statement out just 2 days ago by some figure for Hamas saying that they would never accept the existence of Israel. And that sounds to me a little like a campaign of ethnic cleansing. And that in turn sounds to me like the characteristic of people who don't want to persuade their neighbors or their constituents, but who want to frighten them and terrify them.
This is WLUW Chicago Sound Alliance, and you're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with Professor Philip Bobbitt about his recent book, Terror and Consent. Thanks so much for listening.
Turning to some of the responses that you dedicate in your book to how exactly this war against terror should be fought, and the many aspects that we in current affairs are currently dealing with, I think you said that you support preventative detention of terrorists in some form or another. I think the Obama administration now has pretty clearly stated that it also supports preventative detention in some form or the other. However, what's unclear, I think, is what kind of preventative detention would be A, constitutional, and B, would fit a system that could be justified by a state of consent that's based on the rule of law. I think in your book, you cite some aspects of preventative detention that seem constitutional. So this, essentially, there are some Italian statutes and some French statutes, but many of those are usually only for about 45 days, as you had mentioned in your book. And, you know, preventative detentions like that wouldn't even trigger speedy trial rights of an ordinary criminal defendant even in the United States. So considering that in over here we may face this aspect of war being perpetual, and we may almost never know whether somebody really is a terrorist or not, or whether we should release them, how can we have a scheme like that could ever be constitutional under these conditions?
Well, I myself favor action by Congress in the United States, just as I favor action by Parliament over here. It doesn't always produce the statutes that I might want if I were drafting them, but I think the first element ought to be the consensual element, the fact that we get our decisions ratified by Congress in the United States under our constitutional system. And that's a step that the administration first committed itself to and then now has withdrawn under the pressure from civil liberties lobbyists who say that having no statute is better than having a statute on the books, something I myself don't agree with. As to what protections we ought to have for people who are detained and the duration of their detention, I suppose I would say that after an initial showing before a magistrate or a court, that Congress could set some kind of timeline. I don't know what it would be. It might be 20 days. It might be as long as 60 days. But some sort of time in which people can be held and facts about them can be marshaled, and that then you've got to go back to the court and justify the continued detention, that you can't just throw people away, throw them into a cell and throw away the key. I certainly think that people who are detained have the right to habeas corpus. They have a right to an attorney. If they can't afford an attorney, they ought to be provided an attorney by the state. I don't think they should be held in common with criminal convicts or people who are awaiting trial for crimes. I think they should be sequestered. I think they should have access to written record. And I think Congress is quite capable of writing rules for all of these things and tailoring them to the situation of the 21st century terrorist. What I am less happy with is using the statutes that we have, immigration statutes, material witness statutes, that are really not designed for this purpose, and sort of shoehorning preventive detention in by that backdoor route. I guess I'm mixing my metaphors there. But
another topic that you dedicate several pages in your book to is torture. And I think that you only make one exception. Well, I don't think you make any exceptions to torture. So I think you say that it should never be allowed. recognizing that it would be done in the ticking time bomb situation, even though that hypothetical assumes that it would always reveal information that would be effective at getting the bomb through torture. But leaving aside that, I think the only thing that you approve of is maybe in the case of high Al-Qaeda operatives, maybe we could have perhaps a jury come in and see whether the interrogator is correct first about whether this person is a terrorist, and if so, whether any coercive techniques that would be applied on that person would reveal any beneficial information. And I think that you restrict it to simply coercive techniques like sleep deprivation or giving the person a drug that would lower his inhibitions and make him or her more likely to talk to the interrogator. But essentially you say that a state of consent that's based on the rule of law can never ever sanction torture. Lately, ever since Osama bin Laden has been caught, many of the former Bush aides have essentially just latched on to the idea that either some of the leads came from people in Guantanamo, or that essentially I think one person was renditioned and he may have provided the lead. And from that, they've jumped to the conclusion that coercive interrogation and waterboarding and all those things that we saw them advocating for were correct, and that their position has been vindicated. Where do you stand on that as of today? And B, considering that they essentially are just coming up to a conclusion without really a firm basis. And what we do know is that the people who were tortured and who were faced, who were subjected to coercive interrogation, such as Al-Libbi and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, were the main people who knew most definitely who Osama bin Laden's career was. And the interrogators knew that they were lying, which is probably why they ended up torturing them to get that information. Yet we know now that those people continued to lie and never gave the information. So, B, isn't that a resounding indictment on the whole notion that we should ever practice torture in the sense that it could ever reveal information?
Well, let me deal with this retrospectively and then prospectively. Retrospectively, the people who are giving comments now on the claim that waterboarding gave them leads that led them to a courier who led them to bin Laden, you have a different legal context, because the people who were doing that, the CIA interrogators and perhaps military interrogators, had every reasonable expectation that what they were doing was lawful. They'd gotten opinions from the Department of Justice, they had opinions from their own general counsels, and that's a very different situation than the one we face prospectively. With regard to the future, you state my position very clearly, I think. I thought you did it quite lucidly. I say torture is never lawful. Never. And I associate torture with the infliction of great pain or the fear, not even great, the infliction of pain, just call it pain, or the infliction of a reasonable fear of pain. I think those things can never be lawful. Having said that, just as you note, I say that sometimes, in very, very rare circumstances, we will see human beings deliberately break the law. The anxious father exceeds the speed limit getting his pregnant wife to the emergency room. He knows he's breaking the law. He's doing it deliberately. But he thinks he is saving a life or maybe two lives, by doing it. And he's prepared to take the cost. He's prepared to take the consequences. So prospectively, if someone were to engage in waterboarding in the future for some future Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and he expected to get some comfort from my book, he would have to say, I did it. I did it deliberately. And I want a jury trial. And I will make my case before the jury and let them decide. The because we give juries discretion in just those cases, those very rare, very extreme cases, where to save one life, we break a law. But that's not the same thing as saying it can ever be lawful. And I'm glad that you underscored that point.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor.
Professor, do you mind if Omar asks one more question about the Arab Spring? And
Not at all. Please do.
Well, I think, finally, the best way to wrap up this interview would be to see whether you think that I think once the Arab Spring began, many people from both the right and the left agreed that this had rendered terrorism to some extent as irrelevant, or essentially had really undermined the terrorists. Indeed, I think when Mubarak fell in Egypt, the terrorists really had no response to it. They were speechless. Even the conservative organizations who have renounced violence in Egypt and have participated in parliamentary systems of democracy, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, was fumbling and was not at the epicenter of the youth movement, and really had a very, very small role in the revolution, which has led a lot of people to say that terrorism, at least from an Islamic fundamentalist standpoint, is going to subside, or that many people have realized that it is just not effective. Does that, in any sense, change your thesis or your ideas for terror and consent?
No. On the contrary, the Al Qaeda manifestos always claimed that the autocratic states of the Maghreb, of the Gulf, of the Near East, could not be changed without violence. They always said that this change would never come about until the Americans were absent from the entire region. And they said that the way to mobilize a mass movement was around a very radical form of Islam. And the Arab Spring just sort of dust all those away. So you can see why they were speechless, because it goes against their core claims to the publics of both states. Having said that, the tricky period is still ahead of us. What you worry about is a kind of a Kerensky period in which very respected, often international figures, diplomats, academics, are in the forefront of these social movements. They organize a very broad-based government, and they respect human rights because they've campaigned for those all their lives. And then you enter a period later on of violence, because the terrorists know that they can't, their chances of ruling in that kind of system are greatly diminished. And so they try and burn churches and mosques, they attack civilians from different sects, they try and put the society aflame so that the society itself can be taken over in some sort of coup d'etat by the most violent people in the spectrum. And that's what happened to the revolution in Russia. It's what happened to the revolution in France. It happens. And so I think you have to be very concerned about the period that follows the period that will in turn follow these initial successes.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. I appreciate your questions.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium, and that was our interview with Professor Philip Bobbitt about his book, Terror and Consent. Well, thanks so much for listening today. You can find some of our other interviews at our blog, logicconsortium.blogspot.com, and send us an email with suggestions. And this music is from the Scientific Map. Have a great day, everybody.